Hello, and welcome to the second episode of the Weekly Electronic Paper. In this episode, I'm going to talk about a fairly famous paper that was written by John Wheeler, and I think it's been a very fruitful paper. A lot of people have riffed on it over the years, and even when I did a web search, there were lots of people still talking about it. This is a paper that Wheeler coined the term "it from bit," talking about quantum mechanics, reality, and information theory. Show notes for this episode will be found at papers.physicsfm.com/2. I did look for this paper online, and I got a lot of people referencing this paper, so I might not be able to find a reference for you that would be sufficient. But I will try. I think I'm going to entitle this episode "Itty Bitty Physics." So here I am, talking to you about physics. Well, hello! So last time I was reading this cubism paper, or these two cubism papers by Christopher Fuchs, and I noticed in the references, because I spend too much time looking through the references, that Fuchs had referenced a paper in a book called Complexity, Entropy, and the Physics of Information, which is a book that in the early 90s or maybe mid-90s, I found at a bookstore in Denver, I believe. Actually, I think it was in Littleton. And I was an undergraduate, and it looked really cool, and I didn't understand a word of it. And that's okay, because I've tried reading a little more, and I still don't understand a word of it. And so I decided, well, why don't I take a peek at this? One of the things I could do is I could intersperse finding current papers with going through this book. Now, this book has something like 32 chapters or 32 essays in it by all sorts of people. And the first one is by John Wheeler, which is another reason why I thought about that. But I also saw some other names I knew, PCW Davies, Z and Z, and other important people. So I thought maybe I could go through this and read not just the papers from famous people and not just paper that Fuchs pointed out, but just go through each one of them and every other week or so read one. And then I could intersperse this with newer results and things like that, and just look through what was going on with this idea about what was going on in 1990, what was going on in 1990 in the ideas about information in quantum physics, or information in physics in general. So that's more or less the idea here. So I'd like to just go through this. Like I said, the very first paper here is actually an incredibly famous paper, and I don't know how many people have read it. I mean, obviously, I have all the copies here in my office. I mean, how many copies of a symposium were actually made, right? This was from the symposium at the Santa Fe Institute, I think. Emerged from a meeting held during the week of May 29th to June 2nd, 1989 at St. John's College, Santa Fe. Oh, St. John's, okay. With 40 official participants with an equal number of groupies. Okay. So the physics groupies were hanging out, so you can remember to do that at physics conferences. They would love you to show up as a groupie for all the physics conferences, I'm sure. In this paper by John Wheeler, Information Physics Quantum, The Search for Links, this is basically where Wheeler coins that phrase, it from bit, that has to do with quantum information theory that everybody seems to want to relate to you and tell you that, you know, he said that. And basically what he's trying to say is that the world is mainly an information theoretical device, right? So it's a little bit similar to what Fuchs was saying in the previous podcast about quantum mechanics being purely informational. Now, we're going to find that it's actually a little stronger a statement than Fuchs. All right, so Fuchs was saying the world exists, but the quantum state was just something that existed for us. It was just something that reflected our knowledge. So he was saying that the state and the wave function were the same thing, and whatever the world was doing, and that wave function sort of reveals the state of our ignorance of what the world is actually doing. And one of the fundamental precepts of quantum mechanics in that case would be that whatever the world is doing, it's at a level that we can't actually know it. I'd say something like that. He may disagree. So we don't know what the world is actually doing. We just can learn about the world through this probabilistic device. Wheeler's a little stronger than that. Wheeler is going to say that the world comes together because of our questions about it. And the answers to those questions that we ask are the bits. So when we take a measurement, we're really asking a question. We ask one of these questions. We could be talking about the polarization of a photon or the spin of an electron. Each time we ask one of those questions, we find out an answer. And that's actually creating what's going to happen to the world. And that's actually creating the world. So in between the emission event of a photon, say at the sun, and the absorption event, say in your eye, the photon doesn't have any independent reality, is what Wheeler's going to say. There has to be the observer there to give that photon its independent reality. And that is reflected in what Wheeler says the goal of this is. Wheeler's stated goal is to deduce the quantum from our understanding of existence. The quantum meaning what quantum theory talks about, right? What he's saying is that the quantum is something we don't know, and we want to figure out what that is through the examination of our own existence. It's interesting. Wheeler starts off with these three questions. You know, why is there existence? Why is there something that exists? Why is there this quantum that he's talking about? Why is there this underlying quantum structure of the universe? A third question is if we have so many observers, why is there only one world? So that also is a little bit contra Fuchs. For, of course, with Fuchs, all of the other observers are also part of the quantum wave function, right? So you have your consciousness, but everybody else's consciousness doesn't really interact. With Wheeler, the consciousnesses, that's not a good word, they're all going to come together and produce the world when we communicate. And I think Wheeler got just as much crap about this as Fuchs does about his stuff, because there were some fairly defensive statements about those sorts of things. However, the interesting thing is Wheeler doesn't actually answer any of these questions. Instead of answering these questions, he talks about the framework of what he wants to accomplish, and that's all negative. Those are all going to be negatives. And some clues or some ideas about what sort of things are important in understanding this. So the closest thing he gives to an answer to any of those questions, I think, from reading this, is that H-bar is going to be a clue to the relationship between physics and information, and that makes a little bit of sense. It has something to do with entropy. Entropy, at least mathematically, has something to do with information, and so forth and so on. But what Wheeler tries to do is he tries to circumscribe what you're allowed to talk about in physics, or in this sort of primordial physics that he wants to get into, by disallowing certain things. One is a Tower of Turtles. He doesn't want an infinite regress. You may have heard this before. There's an idea that first you ask a question in science, and then you establish it, and then you ask more questions, and so forth and so on. So first of all, you start to say, well, you know, I know things fall. Now, there's some reasons why that could fall, why something could fall. It could just be that certain things belong on the ground, whereas other things, like balloons and gases, belong in the air. And so when an apple, let's say, or a rock is not on the ground, it tries to find a way to get to the ground. Right? You could say something like that. That's one theory. And then you could play around with that theory for, let's say, 2,000 years until somebody figures out a better one. And you get to this point where somebody deduces that there's this inverse square law of gravity. That's a very interesting thing and explains the heavens and why these things happen. You get there, but you have no foundation, right? You have this law of gravity, but there's nothing behind it, right? You just know things somehow exist, and it gets worse, right? As you start playing around with the models, you find out very, very disconcerting things. For example, gravity doesn't work if gravity is delayed. So electromagnetism, it does work if it's delayed, right? Everything we see in electromagnetism, if something happens at one point and it takes some time to travel to the other point, we can model that, and we can actually get good results, and we can find out things that work. But you can mathematically prove that things that we want gravity to do, like having stable solar systems, doesn't actually work if gravity is not instantaneous in the Newtonian scheme, in the classical scheme. So that's a little bit scary. Most people would find that scary. Gravity has to work instantaneously. Gravity has to go faster than light. So you can't have like little force carriers traveling between the Earth and the Sun. This field is instantaneous and it's all sort of weird. How do we fix things like that? And once you get to the point where nothing's allowed to be traveling between the Earth and the Sun, that gravitational field can't be made up of anything, right? So all these ways to understand how the gravity works, you know, you could have these little corkscrew things coming out of the Sun and pulling the Earth towards it, and that's a real model. That was a real attempt to model what gravity was actually doing. None of these things work. So if none of these things work, then you have this mathematical model of gravity, Newton's law of universal gravitation, but it doesn't tell you about what gravity is. It just tells you about what gravity does. All well and good. Eventually, somebody comes along and he says, well, what if gravity is like, you know, a trampoline or a membrane or something, and you put a little thing here and that creates a change in that membrane, and then you put something else here and it's changing the membrane as well, and, you know, the interactions between that, this stretching and compressing of space-time and all that other stuff creates these interactions that would create a gravitational-like interaction. That's general relativity. That is, rather than looking at gravity as just this attractive force, what you're looking at it is as an idea about how space and time are constituted, not just how they're constituted, not just the relationship between space and time, but you're looking at space and time as the thing that is causing gravity. So the deformations in space-time cause gravity. They are the cause of gravity. But then you get to a point where you say, well, what are space and time? And people have ideas about that, and we don't know how good they are. And in fact, Wheeler's going to have some sort of idea in here that I might talk about, because it's a little bit interesting. And what Wheeler's going to say is there's actually no space and time back at the bottom, so we have to look at that a little bit differently. And that's going to talk about where he thinks quantum gravity should be going. But this regress, this constant shifting down to another level, is exactly what Wheeler does not want to have happen. And the Tower of Turtles is just an idea by William James, right? Who's saying that we don't want the world to rest on an elephant on a turtle. Then, well, what is the turtle on? Well, it's on another turtle, right? And then there's another turtle under that, and so forth and so on. We just keep on going deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper. But we never actually reach the bottom, and there's always another question, and it's all like a four-year-old who's learned the word why. You can always have another why. Why is this? Why is that? Why is this? And at some point, you're not learning anything by the whys. You're just delaying learning things by asking the whys. No Tower of Turtles means he doesn't want any infinite regress, right? Rather, he thinks we should have a circular loop. We should have some sort of loop talking about how physics is built up. And he has a particular loop that he likes. And it involves physics and information and you. So you're very important in this. He also wants to have no laws, right? Or in another way of saying that is there's no eternal law, right? The laws of physics come into being at the Big Bang, and when the universe ends, the laws of physics disappear, and they don't mean anything beyond what's going on in the universe. He's going against this 19th century cosmology, this 19th century view of the world where the entire universe is made up of little gears and things. So the law of gravity is a kind of a gear and or a switch. The same thing for electromagnetism and all these other different things. Everything is nice and well-ordered, and you can put it all together. Instead, he wants the universe to be self-synthesized, and basically you, by interacting with the world, are creating the world in some way. And this is a little bit strange. He's got this weird idea about bits. So it does sound a little bit like Wheeler switched from the mechanical interpretation of the universe to the consumer electronics view of the universe, that the entire world could be on your iPhone, which is apparently very popular these days. The entire universe is a simulation on your iPhone. So we're all in the simulation, but the person who's doing the simulating is also in the simulation, which makes everything a nice infinite regress and loop, like you were saying above. So Wheeler wants to deny that 19th century mechanical interpretation of the universe, this 19th century Kuhn's cosmology, and bring it about into this 21st century cosmology, Actually, this was in 1989, so it's still late 20th century, right? He wants the entire universe to be evolved in your iPhone, which may be possible. You can talk to the Dwarf Fortress guys about setting that up. They've definitely been able to set up an entire universe in your PC. And it doesn't really take that long for them to generate the universe with the history and all that other stuff. But he wants to call that self-synthesized, that we're actually creating it by creating the information, by asking the questions and getting the answers and then communicating those answers. So we have no Tower of Turtles, we have no eternal laws. Next, we have no continuum. Wheeler doesn't believe in continua. He wants the world to be discrete in some measure. And to go along with this, the fourth one, after the no Tower of Turtles, no eternal laws, and no continuum, is there's no space and no time. And this is where he gets into the quantum gravity stuff, where he starts to talk a little bit about, at the scale, at the Planck area, the fluctuations should be about as large as you'd expect that point to be at that very same scale. So basically, quantum fluctuations are as large, at least, as a point. That means you have some problems, and just trying to think about this, like we did in Physics Frontiers with loop quantum gravity, which is in this vein, how do you imagine this quantum foam being connected? Well, the whole idea of connectivity doesn't quite work anymore, right? Because if your fluctuations are as large as your points, you could have reordered points very, very easily. And that's actually part of the point, I think, of loop quantum gravity and other quantum gravities, is that you actually have a probabilistic scheme for all of the different ways that these points could coherently connect. Because, of course, there are rules for their connections. There are ways that they have to connect. But you're looking at what are all those different ways that they could connect. And those probabilities sort of tell you something about space-time. Connectivity becomes a problem. The whole sequential view of time becomes a problem. And so the general idea that there is a space and a time is going to be a phenomenon for the macroscopic scale, for you and me. But really, at the deepest level, there's no foundational space and time. There's no foundational matrix. Everything is always in a state of flux. So those are the four no's. No Tower of Turtles, no infinite regress. No laws, no eternal laws. The world is self-synthesized. No continuum, the world is in some way discrete. No space and no time. Even though the world is discrete, at the smallest level, the world is not well-ordered. So the no's are the constraints on the theory that Wheeler thinks will come from integrating quantum mechanics and information. And he'd like to ask the questions, is why is there existence? Why is there quantum mechanics? And why is there only one world when there are so many observers? And the whole goal is to deduce the quantum from our understanding of existence. So that's where we're going. But he says we have five clues. The boundary of a boundary is zero. If you don't ask any questions, you can't have any answers. Something he calls super Copernicanism. One he calls consciousness. And one is more is different. Some of these things are more sensible than others. So the boundary of a boundary is zero. The first one, he comes back to that several times, but I don't really understand why he does. This is a common mathematical result from algebraic topology. It basically just says that if you have a set and that set has a boundary, that boundary set itself has no boundary. And the question might be, well, why is that? Well, the boundary set is a bunch of limits. And so if you have an object and you go to the limit might not be part of the object. Your sphere might have a boundary, but that boundary is not necessarily part of the object. That boundary is at the edge of the object, so let's say. And it could be part of the object and part not part of the object. It's a little bit odd because it's math, but still you have this set of points which is right at the edge of your object. So you want to take that and you want to find the boundary of that boundary. But now if you started with a ball in three dimensions, you have the spherical boundary in two dimensions, any way you go inside of that sphere is going to be in part of that sphere. You can't have a boundary to an object if that object has no end. And if you take something like a sphere in two dimensions, the shell that's over that ball, then just like any place on the surface of the Earth that you go, you can keep on going and you'll still be on the Earth. It doesn't matter which way you're going. It doesn't matter if you're changing your latitude. It doesn't matter if you're changing your longitude. You're still going to end up somewhere on the surface of the Earth as long as you're constrained to be on the surface of the Earth. And so there is no boundary to the surface of the Earth. The surface of the Earth is the boundary to the Earth. And if you go beyond that boundary, then you're in space. But there is no boundary to that boundary because it's a two-dimensional object. And as long as you're traveling within that object, you're going to end up somewhere on that object. So probably that's an important thing. So there are no limits to that. So that's all it means. But apparently that's supposed to be a clue as to what should happen in the universe. And I'm not sure where that clue is supposed to come from. And so that's the boundary of a boundary is zero. I'm not sure where Wheeler was going with that, but he thought it was very, very important to be one of these five clues. The next clue is, if you don't ask a question, you don't get an answer. He means this in a specific way. At least his example makes it fairly clear. If you had like a Stern-Gerlach device or something like that, which is something we've talked about before, you have, let's say, an electron going through the Stern-Gerlach device, and the Stern-Gerlach device will say, is this electron spin up or spin down in the Z direction? Is it positive Z or negative Z? You could also do that in another direction, let's say the X direction. Is it positive X or negative X? Also, a perfectly fine question to ask. But if you measured the spin in the Z direction, you foregone measuring it in the X direction, which means that you don't have any information about what's happening in the X direction. And so the only things you're allowed to consistently talk about are about how and when and what is measured. And anything that hasn't been measured isn't really part of the conversation. That's starting to sound a little bit like that consistent history stuff that we talked about on Physics Frontiers as well, right? And in addition to this, every time you make a measurement, you're increasing the amount of information people have about the world, right? So if you ask many questions, you'll get many answers. And hopefully that would be helpful. And all of these other things that we want to talk about, like probability and time and so forth, are things that we make up. They don't have any meaning in the lower regions. And quantum mechanics is only about this information, is what he's trying to say. The answers to the questions that you asked, and has nothing to do with the answers to the questions that you never did ask. And because of that, many of the things that we like to talk about with quantum theory, like time evolves in quantum theory. Probability, every time you talk about a wave function, you're talking about amplitudes for a probability function, a probability distribution function. Those are all things that just have to do with us. Those don't have anything to do with the world. That takes us back to Fuchs from last time and several episodes of Physics Frontiers. And so those give us the boundary of a boundary is zero for one clue. The next clue was no question and no answers. And the next one is super Copernicanism. So if you remember, the thing that Copernicus did was he shifted the center of our focus of the study of the solar system from the Earth, or from us, to the Sun, to the thing way out there, to something that has nothing to do with us. And Wheeler calls that here-centeredness. These days we probably call it here-centrism, because we love our isms. You know, modern society couldn't live without isms. And what Wheeler wants to do is he wants to do that for time as well. He wants to get away from focusing on our time, our now-centrism, our now-centeredness, and try to talk about the world in some way that does not give now a special meaning. This is going to be a little weird because actually it sounded a lot like you wanted to give now a special meaning. And I mean that because he says, more or less, that the past exists only insofar as it is recorded in the present. Anything that's gone, anything that's happened, but nobody remembers, nobody has any way of finding out what happened, just doesn't happen. It doesn't mean anything anymore. And any theory that has a really strong place for measurement, let's say quantum mechanics, can't be the basis for what's happening. What he's probably trying to say here is that we've built this quantum mechanics and measurement is fundamental to it. The whole Born rule is fundamental to it. Anything that requires an observer can't be fundamental in discussing something where there were no observers. Let's say the early universe. During the early universe, there was too much energy. Nobody could, in principle, be observing anything because nothing complex could, in principle, exist because there was so much energy just destroying everything as well as creating things. without those observations, the theory doesn't mean anything. And then the past can't be inferred from the present. So we get this really weird system going on where the past exists insofar as it's recorded in the present, but we can't infer the past from the present, which is a little odd way to talk about these things. But some ideas here are that, say, the fine structure constant, and therefore other values like the charge of the electron, change in different environments, in extreme environments. I'd like to look at that in the future. So now we have three of the clues. The boundary of a boundary is zero. If you don't ask any questions, you get no answers. And supercopernicanism, if that's really a clue. The fourth one gets to consciousness. And whenever you quote Parmenides, it's getting a little weird. And what Wheeler quotes is, that which is identical with the thought that recognizes it. And I think we can all understand what he means by that. That at least in our interaction with the world, the things that we recognize are the things that we interact with, even if they're not the fundamental things. Even if the world is something else, the things that we see are the things we interact with, even if they're not really the things that are there. And you can try that on acid if you don't believe me. Now, to build a more coherent view of the world, you have to build meaning, and to build meaning, you have to communicate, right? And so the world is just the joint product of the evidence available to everybody who's capable of taking a measurement, what Wheeler's calling an observer participant. And then he wants the observer participancy because if you're not a participant, then the whole thing falls down. So we've gone through, the first clue was the boundary for the boundary is zero. If you ask no questions, you get no answers. Supercopernicanism and consciousness. And then we have more is different, which is, you know, a paragraph. And it's basically complexity and emergence. As you get large numbers of things interacting, you get phenomena that don't look like the smaller scale. Superconductivity is a really great example. So that's the last of the five clues. And those are all supposed to, again, bring us to the point where we can deduce the quantum for our understanding of existence. So that's why we're talking about the consciousness stuff and we're talking about the complexity stuff and so on, is because we want to look at what the quantum really is from understanding existence. And those clues are supposed to help us answer the questions, why is there existence? Why is there a quantum? And why is there only one world when there are so many observers? And Wheeler thinks that this whole thing is a cycle, like we said. With Tower of Turtles, he wants a cycle, not a pillar, not a tower. Not this infinite tower, where the bottom is someplace you can't find. And the cycle he proposes is that elementary quantum phenomena are closed by irreversible acts of amplification. So we have to look at that photon coming from the sun and being absorbed by your eye as being one process. Although it takes a lot of time, there's no photon in between. The photon is the connection at the ends, right? This entire connection, this entire thing. This irreversible act of amplification is something Niels Bohr said, but it's a spot where discussion becomes part of the world. It's a spot where a question was asked. So we've asked that question, we've got an answer. So part two would be the information is expressed as a bit. We've asked a yes or no question, and we've got a yes or we've gotten a no. We asked up or down, we've gotten up or we've gotten down. So we take that information, and to have gotten that information, we had to ask that. So we need the observer participants, right? We need you. And we need many of those to establish meaning. And then we get the observers and the bit exchange with the communication, and that is what we call existence. And that's supposed to loop on back down into the elementary quantum phenomena. So that is the general cycle that Wheeler has in mind. Okay, and so the things that Wheeler wanted to assert, the things that he wanted people to think about were that the world is not ruled by continuum laws. We talked about that. We want the world to be somehow discretized. He spent a lot of time saying there's no rational proof that the world has to be continuous, which is maybe a little bit iffy, but I think a lot of people would be happy to say that at the low down smallest chunk of the world, it's got to be discrete. But we don't get anything like space and time. Two, there's no space and no time at the microscopic level. Down at the very root of reality is this pulsating, fluctuating quantum foam that does not really preserve connectedness and continuity the way we generally think about it in the macroscopic sense. And that's been developed quite a bit. We've already talked about that. That's been developed quite a bit for quantum gravity theories. And the continuum idealizations that we use conceal the information theoretic truth. And so he's gotten a little bit stronger here in what he's saying. So those first two were interesting things that you could explore. Now we are in this spot where we're talking about something that's a little more philosophical than physical, with the assertion that there is an information theoretic truth, and our physical laws actually impede our ability to understand that. And the fourth thing that he wanted to say was observer participancy is the closest thing to the primordial physics that will ever be. The fact that when we observe something, that causes things to come into being or is a harsh break from the evolutionary chain of the universe. That is something he thinks is very important. And so those are the things Wheeler wants to talk about. Again, he called that it from bit. Existence comes from information. What exactly a bit was, he doesn't know. He leaves that open. And he tries to give some ideas about that, talking about the Bekenstein entropy, a magnetometer, and the gravitational field, saying what could be the bit involved with that. But I didn't feel those were really well-formed thoughts. I think they were thrown out there as sort of examples, but they don't really get directly at what a bit is. So I won't talk about those too much. And I think that's more or less Wheeler's it from bit, at least as he originally described it in Information Physics Quantum, The Search for Links, in this proceedings paper from 1989. Well, it was copyright 1990, published 1990, but the conference was in 1989. All right, bye now. You have just listened to the Weekly Electronic Paper, Episode 2, Itty Bitty Physics. Show notes for this episode can be found at papers, with an S, .physicsfm.com/2. As I said at the beginning, I'm not sure what I'm going to be able to find to put in there for you, but I'll try to find something. If you have comments or suggestions or anything of the sort, you can put comments in that spot at papers.physicsfm.com/2. Thank you.